This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I tried to save the world last fall.
While death and disease stalks the nations, while protests fill the streets, nature is still rumbling with huge changes that will rock your world. Ready or not, the heat, storms, and rising seas are showing up this year and every year to come. In this show, we will go to the far ends of the earth to find that, to Antarctica, where new science shows the big ice sheets melted 6 times faster than we are seeing now, just a few thousand years ago, and to Siberia, where fires can rise out of the winter snow and temperatures this spring are off the charts. We are beset by pandemic, unemployment, and social disorder. None of that stops the forces set in motion by our alteration of the land, seas, and atmosphere. The clock of climate change is running, but how fast? Now, from the far reaches of the world, we have evidence that vast ice shelves in Antarctica can retreat 10 times faster than anything we are seeing today. This is credible new science from the Scott Polar Research Institute at Cambridge University. It follows discoveries made from an icebreaker on the far frozen side of Antarctica. There, advanced drones revealed a record of rapid ice retreat, and not that long ago. From Cambridge, our guest is the expedition chief scientist, Professor Julian Dowdswell. Professor, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Please tell us about that polar research ship and when this expedition took place.
The research you've described was undertaken on an expedition called the Weddell Sea Expedition 2019. And we went on the South African research icebreaker called Agulhas II into the Weddell Sea. And the aim was to try and reach the area of the Larsen Sea ice shelf, which is on the eastern side of the Antarctic Peninsula. Now, the difficulty with this is that the sea there is covered in most years, for almost the whole year, in floating sea ice, which makes access very difficult. And that's why we had to use an icebreaker like Agulhas II. But we benefited from the fact that a very large iceberg called A68, about 140 kilometres or about 100 miles long, had broken off from the Larsen Sea ice shelf a couple of years ago. And that, to some extent, protected the area of, that we wanted to access from the worst of the sea ice. So we were actually able, and this is one of the first times in several years that the area has been accessible at all, we were actually able to get the icebreaker in. And then, at certain points, we were able to launch our, as you say, submarine drones or autonomous underwater vehicles with a very high-resolution method of imaging the seafloor. This is a method called multi-beam echo sounding. Now, most people will be familiar with a boat or a ship with a single-beam echo sounder that just measures the water depth immediately beneath the vessel. But a multi-beam echo sounder has about 200 of these beams, which are sent out in a fan shape from the drone just 60 metres above the sea floor, and images, therefore, a whole swathe of the sea floor in very great detail. And because our drones are flying not from the surface 500 metres above the sea floor, but only 60 or 70 metres above the sea floor, that means they get a very high-resolution elevation picture of what the shape of the seafloor is like. And it's this very high-resolution picture that allowed us to image some very delicate sub-meter-scale seafloor ridges, which we think are formed by the upward and downward motion of the point that the ice shelf becomes detached from the seafloor. So if we think of the Antarctic ice sheet, the bulk of the edge of Antarctica, there is a floating ice shelf that fringes the interior of the ice sheet. Now, the two are dynamically a single entity in the sense that ice from the interior of Antarctica flows into the ice shelf and actually feeds the flow of the ice shelf. But the ice shelf becomes detached when it's fully buoyant. It becomes detached from the sea floor. And it's that point, which we call the grounding line, that moves up and down each time the tide goes in and the tide goes out. And what that does is, as the tide goes out and the grounding line sits down on the seafloor, it pushes up a little ridge. Now, if the ice shelf was advancing, then the ridge would be obliterated within hours to days. But because in this case the ice shelf is retreating at the point that these features were formed, that means that each tide, each 12 or so hours, you get another little ridge formed, and it's not obliterated because the grounding line, that interface where the ice becomes detached from the seafloor, is actually retreating. So we image up to 90 of these backstepping one behind the other, spaced about 20, 25 metres apart. And if we have the view that each one of those little ridges is formed by a tidal cycle every 12 hours, that gives us a record of 45 days. And because we know the amount of retreat, about 20 to 25 metres each 12 hours, that allows us to work out what the rate of the retreat per day is, about 50 metres per day. And then if we average that up over a year, it allows us to conclude that at this point, during the deglaciation of the Antarctic ice shelf about 11, 12,000 years ago, the retreat was actually up to about 10 kilometres or so per year. Now, that's a very interesting number, because if we switch to the modern environment of Antarctica and we look at satellite imagery, which can measure the modern retreat of the grounding line of, for example, the very sensitive Thwaites Pine Island part of the West Antarctic Ocean, which is known to be thinning and retreating quite fast in modern terms, the rate of retreat there is a maximum of about 1.6 kilometres per year, and that is thought to be very fast. But what our results therefore show is that the retreat can, and has been in the fairly recent past, almost 10 times this, 10 kilometres per year, rather than just 1.6. And the reason this is important is because, of course, we had satellite imagery of the fringes of Antarctica for about 40 or 50 years, and we've been able to use complex radar systems from satellites over the past 15 years or so to work out the details of changing velocities and advance and retreat rates. So 15 years is a very short window over which to assess the variability and retreat rates of a whole continent worth of ice. And remember, the Antarctic is bigger than the whole size of Europe, about the same size as North America. So the geological record of these beautiful, very delicate backstepping landforms allows us then to work out 11 or 12,000 years ago, retreat of the ice shelf grounding line was an order of magnitude or about 10 times greater than it is today.
That's not very long ago. I mean, civilization is thought to have started perhaps 8,000 years ago, 10,000 at the most. So just before we started to form cities and become sort of modern selves, there was a major retreat of the ice sheets around Antarctica. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's right. I mean, the last time that ice on the globe was a lot more extensive than it is today was about 20,000 years ago. That's what we call the last glacial maximum. Some people call it the last ice age. And at that time, North America was covered by ice right down to the Great Lakes, and New York was covered by ice and so on and so on. And Europe, the ice covered much of Britain, the whole of Scandinavia, parts of Western Russia as well. And so there was a huge amount more ice 20,000 years ago than there is today. And in fact, one of the outcomes of that was that 20,000 years ago, global sea level was 125 metres or somewhat over 300 feet lower than it is today, because the water that built those ice sheets was actually abstracted out of the global ocean. And so both from the geological evidence of past ice sheets 20,000 years ago and from the records of sea level change, we can show that there was more ice on land and therefore less water in the global ocean at 20,000 years ago. But after 20,000, between about 15 and 12,000 years ago, let's say, the climate of the world warmed quite appreciably, and we came out of that ice age or full glacial conditions. And what we're seeing on the Antarctic continental shelf in 500 metres of water today is that at 11,000 or so years ago, the ice front, the grounding line, actually retreated through that point at a rate of about 10 metres per year.
And just, I know there's going to be some confusion with my listeners between sea ice loss, as we see quite a bit in the Arctic, and ice sheet retreat. Can you tell us the difference and why it matters so much?
Yeah, this is a really good question, and it's a fundamental question. So it's really important to distinguish between sea ice on the one hand and glaciers and ice sheets on the other. Now, sea ice is simply the frozen surface of the sea. Sea ice is usually only a few meters in thickness, but it covers vast areas of the Arctic and the Antarctic, particularly during winter. So sea ice, for example, in Antarctica would vary between about 18 million square kilometers of cover in the winter to just 2 or 3 million in the summer. And the same is true in the Arctic. So sea ice is simply the frozen sea surface. It's not as salty as the sea from which it freezes, because part of the salts are actually rejected at the point of freezing of the sea ice. So sea ice is simply frozen seawater. It's really thin, but covers huge areas. Glaciers and ice sheets, on the other hand, are very thick. Glaciers are often a few hundred meters, so let's say about 800,000 feet thick. And ice sheets, the thickest ice sheet in the world is the East Antarctic Ice Sheet, and that is up to, the Antarctic Ice Sheet is up to 5 kilometers or about 3 miles in thickness. But those glaciers and ice sheets are formed in a completely different way from sea ice. They are formed from the precipitation of snow. They're formed from snowfall, and that snow falls on the ground or falls on the ice sheet, and it doesn't all melt during the summer. More falls the next winter. Not all of it melts in the summer. More falls again the winter after that, and it builds up and up and up and thickens. And as it thickens, the weight of the overlying snow also densifies the snow beneath it, and it turns into glacier ice. Glacier ice is simply snow from which all the little pathways through which air might go are closed off. So the density of snow is about 400 kilograms per cubic meter, and the density of ice is about 900 kilograms per cubic meter. So it's about double the density of snow. So ice is simply densified snow from which all the little air pathways have been removed. And so glaciers and ice sheets are formed by the precipitation and build-up of snow on land, whereas sea ice is simply the frozen sea surface. And you're right, they do react in different ways to climate change.
So if we were to experience such a rapid retreat in Antarctica, how much new water would that add to the world's oceans, and would that change current sea level projections published by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change?
Yeah, I think the important thing to remember here is the features that we show on the Antarctic seafloor are actually demonstrating retreat over a fairly limited period. And we don't expect retreat on the order of 10 kilometers per year to continue over decades, and certainly not over centuries. So it is a relatively short-term phenomenon that probably would act over a year to a few years. And that, indeed, if it happened to a big ice shelf system in Antarctica, would put a little spike into the sea level rise curve. But it certainly does not mean to say that the whole Antarctic ice sheet is going to disappear in a number of centuries. It's not. The Antarctic ice sheet is going to be here in thousands or even tens of thousands of years. It's likely.
But obviously one expedition cannot get a record for all of Antarctica. How do you know your results are not local, perhaps limited to that part of the polar coast?
Really good question. And we have been able, using these autonomous vehicles or drones, to get the most comprehensive coverage over actually an area of about 9 kilometres, several square miles, looking at these features over a relatively large area. We think that a number of reports of these backstepping ridges, which only contain single tracks and are actually at lower resolution, are almost certainly the same features that we report. And those have been observed in several areas of the Antarctic. But because the equipment that the previous workers had was more limited, it's only when we actually get to see a significant area of that with significant lateral continuity that we can say with a high level of certainty that these are actually related to retreat of the grounding line. So I think these features have been observed before, but they haven't been recognized in full for what they are because of the lack of resolution in the systems that acquired the data.
Professor Dodswell, do we know what set off that retreat?
In general, the retreat of the Antarctic ice sheet and the North American ice sheet too, from cold, full glacial conditions 20,000 years ago to the interglacial conditions that we live in today, which are a number of degrees warmer, of course, than that 20,000 years ago. That sequence of glacial, interglacial cycles, warmer and cooler periods in Earth history, has been repeated over the last 2.5 million years or so with a series of cold and a series of warm periods. Now, these are much longer timescales than something generational, decadal, or century scale. These are related to changes that take place over thousands to tens of thousands of years. Each of these cycles is thought to be about 100,000 years long. And the driver or the pacemaker of those glacial interglacial cycles, of which there have been 20-something over the last 2.5 million years, is understood to be changes in the radiation input to the Earth from the Sun. The Earth orbits around the Sun, but its orbit is not completely consistent. It wobbles and it tilts, and there's a periodicity to each of those behaviors. And the strongest period of radiation change is actually a cycle of 100,000 years. And it's thought that those radiation changes relating to the slight changes in the orbit of the Earth around the Sun are actually the drivers of those glacial, interglacial cycles. Now, the amount of radiation change is nothing like enough to give us the amount of temperature change that we see on Earth between glacials and interglacials. And it is thought then that internal functioning of the atmosphere, ocean, ice system actually enhance or damp down those initial changes in the amount of solar radiation received in the atmosphere. So it's the periodicity of these astronomical variations, if you like, that is the ultimate driver, but it's internal behaviors of the atmosphere, ocean, ice system that amplify those to get the magnitude of glacial to interglacial change that we actually see.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Is your research able to tell us or to tell governments when this rapid ice meltback could begin?
No, sadly not. It's really difficult to do that. Because the linked atmosphere-ocean ice system is so complex, I'm not a numerical modeler, but numerical modelers are trying to deal with this complexity to make predictions, firstly, about what's happening today, to actually make predictions about what's happened in the recent past so that they can test their models, and then to take their models forward to show how things might change, if you like, over the coming century. It's difficult to do this. One of the reasons that I think our recent paper on these delicate seafloor features is quite important is that it actually shows that the retreat of an ice sheet can be a lot faster than we previously thought. And that means that if numerical model predictions predict greater rates of retreat than one might have observed in the satellite record of the last 15 or 20 years, then we would now regard those retreat rates as much more plausible than we would have done in the absence of any modern evidence to show that ice sheets could actually retreat at that rate.
I'm finding science not related to the pandemic is thinning down. The Scott Polar Research Institute says it is closed during the disease. Cambridge, I believe, has announced no on-site classes but all online courses for next fall. Do you think the pandemic and possibly the economy crashing could slow down critical climate science?
Yeah, it's difficult to say. I mean, we've been able to, since the lockdown in the UK, we've been able to get everybody working reasonably satisfactorily from home. And so actually a lot of the science that we're doing and a lot of the modelling and a lot of the satellite-based work that we're doing is proceeding at the moment. But clearly, if measures such as distancing and the lack of being able to fly and so on continue for example, next year, this will start to hit the field-based components of our research because we clearly can't go into the field in either the Antarctic or the Arctic right now. So I think that there could be a slowdown in the fieldwork element of this. But I very much hope that a lot of the satellite work can and is continuing. And if I could just comment on Cambridge and teaching, because, of course, I and others in the Scott Polar Research Institute deliver undergraduate lectures as well. The intention is that unless things improve significantly, we will deliver our set-piece lectures, if you will, to 100 or so people remotely. But the hope, and it is that at the moment, is that a lot of the small group teaching in groups of one or two or three, which is a tradition in Cambridge, it is hoped that that could continue. And it remains to be seen with how the epidemic develops as to whether we would be able to do that. So the hope is that the small group teaching may be able to be delivered in person, but the large group lectures, it appears unlikely that that will be so.
As soon as I saw your new science and that sort of emphasized other science I've seen, that things can move faster than we previously imagined, I thought, do we really have the luxury to postpone the climate convention, the COP25, for at least a year, or should we try and hold that online as well?
It's actually quite hard to hold some of these things online. I mean, one of the two very big international conferences for the geosciences are the annual American Geophysical Union meeting in San Francisco each December, and the European Geosciences Union meeting, which is usually held in Vienna in May. Now, the Vienna meeting was held remotely, and it was really difficult to actually have the same level of interaction, even with what are, in part at least, rather set-piece 15-minute science talks with images and so on and so on. We had 200 people on various platforms trying to interact together, and it wasn't very easy. And when the nature of a meeting is as political as it is scientific, the actual face-to-face discussions and the small breakout groups and so on, I think are particularly important in trying to get things done. So I can see that it would be quite tricky to actually have that take place remotely.
And we're running out of time here, but I would like to hear just a little bit about the search for the ship Endurance, and keep in mind that perhaps a younger generation have not heard of Sir Ernest Shackleton.
Sure. The other part of our Weddell Sea 2019 expedition, after we completed the site, was to use the autonomous vehicles to try and photograph an image at very high resolution, the wreck of Sir Ernest Shackleton's ship, Endurance. Now, what was Shackleton doing in Antarctica? He was one of the early explorers of Antarctica, together with people such as Captain Scott and the Norwegian Roald Amundsen. Amundsen, of course, was the first person to get to the South Pole, followed by Scott. So after Amundsen and Scott had reached the South Pole, just over 100 years ago, in 1911 and 1912, Shackleton, one of the other big polar explorers at the time, thought, what is the great challenge still to be done? And he said, what it is a transantarctic expedition to go from one side of Antarctica to another. And remember that very few people had actually been in Antarctica up till this time. It was very much at the forefront of exploration. Antarctic exploration just over 100 years ago was very much like we perceive people going to the moon. It was very new. It was the headline stuff. And Shackleton said, right, the South Pole's been reached. Now I will undertake a transantarctic expedition, starting on one side of Antarctica and going to the other side via the South Pole. However, on the way down to start the expedition, his ship was trapped in the sea ice, the frozen sea surface, and drifted for 10 months. And the ship was eventually so badly damaged that it sank, crushed by the sea ice, sank through the sea ice to the seafloor. And Shackleton and his 27 men escaped in three open boats, first part of the journey, and then after that, six of them went on an 800-mile open boat journey through very dangerous seas of the Southern Ocean to get rescue, to come back and pick up the rest of the people. So this is one of the epic small boat journeys and rescues ever undertaken. So that's the background to the story. The ship was sunk in an area of the Weddell Sea, which is almost always ice-covered the whole time. So we managed to get the icebreaker into that area, and how did we know where it was? Well, Shackleton and Frank Worsley, who was one of his, Worsley was the captain of the Endurance, and Shackleton was actually the leader of the expedition. So Worsley, using sextant and theodolite, measured quite accurately the position at which the Endurance sank. So that position's been known for 100 years. The records are held in the Scott Polar Research Institute and in New Zealand, and we know, therefore, pretty much where the ship sank. The Agulhas II, an icebreaker, was able to get there, although only for 36 hours in very tricky ice conditions. They were able to launch one of the autonomous vehicles, and that vehicle did a series of traverses around the last known position of the wreck. But when it was about halfway through its mission, it disappeared from it stopped sending information back to the parent ship. It just sent a little bleep back to the parent ship every so often, and it just disappeared. So we still don't know whether the little drone actually imaged the Endurance or not, because unless the drone comes back, it collects so much data in the form of these images that you can't downlink them through the eye, through the water. They have to actually be recovered when the vehicle is recovered. So the vehicle was lost, and we still don't know whether it actually took images of the ship or not. But it seemed to be one of the great wrecks of the world that has yet to be imaged, and that's because it's in such a difficult location concerning sea ice. And it's particularly famous because of Shackleton's epic survival against the odds after the ship was sunk and he was left in the middle of Antarctica with just three open boats.
But Antarctica has kept this secret in mystery again.
That's right.
Do you have more work planned?
We have work going on in the Institute in Greenland, in Antarctica, and in Svalbard. And we shall hope to continue doing that field work as soon as the pandemic or the aftermath of it allows. And in the meantime, we shall continue doing satellite analysis of the behavior of the modern grounding lines and the modern floating ice shelves of Antarctica, which indeed several people in the Institute are working on today.
We have been speaking with Professor Julian Dowdeswell, director of the Scott Polar Research Institute. He is lead author of the paper, Delicate Seafloor Landforms Reveal Past Antarctic Grounding Line Retreat of Kilometers Per Year, and it was published in the journal Science on May 29th. Julian Dowdeswell, thank you for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Siberia was blasting hot in May 2020. With some places almost 40 degrees Fahrenheit, 22 degrees C above average. Locals described skipping a season, going straight from winter into a hot summer. Massive forest fires in northern Russia erupted in the heat, releasing their carbon into the sky. Is this a case of global warming driving more global warming? During the pandemic, it's hard to get reports from the ground, but the satellite eyes in the sky are still working. I reached out to Mark Parrington, senior scientist and wildfire expert at the European Union's Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service, or CAMS. Mark told us about smoke from Arctic fires in a Radio EcoShock interview last September. Now Parrington and other experts worry these new fires, practically popping out of the snow, survived the winter to burn again. Zombie fires. But on the climate change angle, prepare to be surprised. Mark Parrington, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thank you.
Mark, please describe what a zombie fire is and why you and other scientists believe this could be happening.
A zombie fire is it's kind of a catchy term for a type of fire, which is often called a holdover fire or sometimes an overwintering fire, which is a fire that is no longer burning at the surface, but may be occurring where there were fires in the last fire season that then burn at very low temperature, so they smolder underground through the winter months and then may resurface in the spring when any snow or ice has melted from the surface.
And why do you think it could be happening? What are the signals?
Well, we're focusing on fires in the Siberian part of the Arctic again. And what's been quite interesting is where some of the satellite observations have been showing active fires. We can zoom in and see in the visible imagery that there is smoke there. But they're occurring in places where we know there was fires last summer. And also they're occurring in places where just a couple of weeks ago, that land looked very frozen. And so the fact that they're coming on very quickly leads to speculation that they might be then ignited from these resurfacing zombie fires. Also because they're happening in very remote locations, there are some human settlements there, but we don't know exactly what the source of ignition is, and that's what's leading the speculation that there could be these zombie fires.
Your paper notes that without confirmation on the ground, science cannot be positive zombie fires are happening. Where are these fires? Are they accessible? Can ground confirmation be arranged, or is that already happening?
Well, we know for sure that this type of fire does occur in Alaska, for example. There has been field work where they identify these fires and where they resurface. But the reason we're focusing on right at the moment is Siberian part of the Arctic, where there hasn't been that ground confirmation or people on the ground going to observe those. And so without that, it's very difficult to say precisely what the ignition of those fires would be. And like I said, that's what's then hinting that it may be these kind of zombie or holdover fires.
Is the Arctic fire season extending in length?
It's difficult to say. I mean, last summer when we first started seeing that very extreme number of fires and the fire intensity, particularly in the Siberian Arctic, if you'd have asked me this concept of an Arctic fire season, then I would hesitate to call it a season as such. I mean, certainly through the summer months from middle of May through till maybe the end of September even, what we call the boreal fire season, so fires in the northern hemisphere in the boreal forests. And then obviously the Arctic region is an extension much further north from that zone. But even then you would see that the sort of peak in the number of fire detections and the sort of duration of them would be around those same sort of months, except you wouldn't necessarily see such a clear increase in activity between them. It might be just a few days at a time over the summer months. Whereas last summer, what we saw from the beginning of June through till almost the end of August, elevated fire activity in the Arctic Circle, particularly over Siberia, which then starts to look much more like a season. But that still looks like 1 year out of the 17 years that we have data where it shows that kind of a daily trend.
Well, let's go to the tropics where 2 billion people live. How much carbon dioxide was released by tropical wildfires in 2019, and how does that compare to previous years or decades?
The data that we have, of course, is global for global fire activity. And what we've been paying most of our attention to over the last couple of months, well, from the beginning of the year, are fire seasons in the northern hemisphere tropics, particularly in Central America and the upper Asian region of Southeast Asia. And so in terms of the carbon emissions, we're seeing approximately 15 megatons of carbon estimated for Central America. So that includes the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico all the way through Central America to Panama. And we also see from the upper Asian region about 70 megatons of carbon. But if we put that in the context of the previous 17 years of data that we have, so we have a data set that goes back to 2003, actually those numbers are at fairly average levels. And actually we don't necessarily see a big degree of year-to-year variability in the total emissions estimated for the fire season.
In 1997 or 98, carbon from Indonesian peat fires reportedly made that developing country the number three source of greenhouse gases in the world behind the U.S. and China. What was the 2019 fire season like in Indonesia?
2019 fire season for Indonesia. It was quite interesting. It was at quite high levels through September and into October, and it's quite unusual because it wasn't an El Nino year. The El Nino Southern Oscillation was at relatively neutral levels during last year. But there was this other climate anomaly called the Indian Ocean Dipole, which was in a very strong positive phase. And what that meant was that it was much drier over Indonesia than it would normally be. And so we saw increased fire activity that in some days for a week or so was at the same levels as what we saw in, say, 2015. But then they did experience more rain through October. And so overall, it wasn't such a high year in terms of the emissions that we estimated from the fires.
Are the fires visible from satellites really wildfires, or were they started to clear away forests for palm oil plantations or mines or other human use?
I think this is a good question, and it's an important one to bear in mind when we're using satellite observations and looking at fires in the Earth system, because what the satellite is observing, or what the sensor on the satellite more precisely is observing, is actually a thermal anomaly. So it's an anomaly in the brightness temperature at the surface, which is when there's a heat source will register in the detector, and that's the information that we're using. And so it doesn't really distinguish between what the source of those thermal anomalies are. So it could be fires from used for different purposes, so whether it's for agriculture, actual wildfires or forest fires, or other open burning. But it could also be from volcanoes. Gas flaring and oil flaring also show up in the sensor. And while we can try and take into account those non-fire related signals, there are still the data that we do have then for fires doesn't really distinguish what the type of fire is burning.
When is the next tropical fire season, Mark, and are we able to predict how severe it may be?
Well, the tropics is quite interesting because of the tropics in the Northern Hemisphere. Most generally, they have their fire season from January through till April, May for that upper Asian part of Southeast Asia and Central America. But then also the northern tropical countries of Africa have a fire season that is almost the exact opposite of what the southern hemisphere tropical African countries have. So basically from November through till May is the peak of the fire activity there, and then in the months, the 6 months in between, it switches to the southern hemisphere. So we are expecting to see an increase now in fire activity in southern tropical Africa, but then of course in Indonesia and then in the Amazon, their peak fire seasons will come through August, September, and October. And it's very difficult to predict how those are going to be. Again, I saw earlier this week that the seasonal forecast for the El Nino conditions is to be relatively neutral this year. And so in that respect, we may not expect to see such extreme fire conditions. But one of the missing variables that we cannot predict with any certainty is the ignition. So we know if they're agricultural fires, they'll be started at a particular time of the year after the wet season to prepare the land for growing crops. But then in terms of wildfires and anything on top of that, on top of those agricultural fires, it's really difficult to know ahead of time.
Are there countries, Mark, where carbon from wildfires is actually decreasing? And what is the bottom line for CO2 emission trends in the tropics?
So overall, in a worldwide sense, fire activity and fire emissions are decreasing year to year. And this is mostly driven by fire activity in the tropics. And the reason it's declining, or has been declining generally in a general sense since 2003, is because of how land practices and land management practices have been changing in the tropical regions. And so it's true that in some countries we are starting to see in recent years a generally upward trend in the fire activity. And in some places this upward trend has been observed for a much longer period of time. So, for example, from California and Alaska, they're seeing generally an increasing trend in the number of extreme fires. But then there are a lot of places around the world where actually the trend is either flat or declining.
Science itself is facing a challenge from the coronavirus pandemic. Some people would like to get teams together and put them on the ground in Antarctica or other places to do observations, and they're wondering whether that's safe to do. I'd like to get your personal opinion as a scientist. Will the pandemic affect your work, and could it make us more dependent on the eyes from space observations?
Well, clearly the pandemic and the lockdown effects taken on by governments to keep people safe is affecting everybody, and it's affecting my work as well. So the team that I work in, we're all now currently working from home and teleworking and meeting through video conferencing. But we have the advantage where we work mostly with computers and satellite data, and actually working like that is not so different to when we work together as a team. But I do have plenty of colleagues who go into the field regularly, and of course it's making their task much more difficult to be able to do that, to do the science and to do the measurements, but to be able to do that safely. And I'm also aware that in terms of wildfires and wildfire management, there are very real concerns in some parts of the world where how can you effectively manage and fight wildfires while maintaining a social distance. And so there's a lot of factors to be taken into account from a scientific point of view, but also a point of view of managing and controlling wildfires when they're threatening infrastructure and posing a risk to people and settlements. But everybody's having to learn to adapt and to manage as best as we can.
How can the public, my listeners, use Copernicus information to understand what is happening around the world?
Well, all the Copernicus data from all the data services. So I work in the Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service, and the organization I work for is the European Weather Center. We also have the Copernicus Climate Change Service. All of that data is completely free and open access, and so it can be downloaded and looked at by anybody that's interested. On the websites, there are now some tools which have been developed for being able to, rather than download the data directly to your computer, you can put it into a space in the so-called cloud and look at data in that way. And then we have a whole lot of support that's available for helping people to access the data and to understand it and to understand what it's showing in the application they might be interested in using it for.
Mark Parrington, thank you so much for sharing your time with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
That fire report from Mark Parrington turned out to be better news than I expected. The Copernicus satellite monitoring system has been reporting the numbers of fires of all kinds have been decreasing since accurate sensors began reporting in 2003, and this despite global warming. He also told us emissions from wildfires have also been declining over the last 17 years. But let's review. Parrington said, quote, "Overall, in a worldwide sense, fire activity and fire emissions are decreasing year to year, and this is mostly driven by fire activity in the tropics. The reason it is declining, or has been declining in a general sense since 2003, is because of how land practices and land management practices have been changing in the tropical region. So it's true that in some countries we are seeing in recent years an upward trend in the fire activity. And in some places, this upward trend has been observed for a much longer period of time. So, for example, from California and Alaska, they are seeing generally an increasing trend in the number of extreme fires. But then, there are a lot of places around the world where actually the trend is either flat or declining." End quote from Mark Parrington in our radio interview. I found this hard to believe. It is running against my own experience and what we have heard from other forest experts. Satellites don't lie, but should we accept these conclusions about declining emissions? And does that mean wildfires are not adding carbon to the atmosphere, leading to more global warming? By the way, Mark Parrington did not say that. To start, We need to remember the old story of blind men experiencing an elephant for the first time. Each described the elephant like the part they were holding, whether a tail or a massive leg. My radio studio is located in British Columbia on Canada's west coast. We just went through two extreme fire years, declared emergencies, back to back. The risk was high, smoke was too dense to breathe outside, we had to prepare to evacuate at any time. So I have a personal lens worrying about fires burning in the world, and I bet people living in other fire hotspots from Siberia to the Amazon to Australia feel the same way.
Deutsche Welle Radio, Living Planet.
Hello and a very warm welcome to this week's edition of Living Planet. I'm Anya Coopers in Bonn. Deforestation is now known to be a contributor as well. Could you tell me how serious deforestation is as a contributor compared to, let's say, industrial pollution or car exhaust fumes?
Actually, as a single source, deforestation is the second most important source after production of electricity and heating. And so at the global level, if you look at deforestation, it contributes about 20% of all the carbon dioxide, all the greenhouse gases, rather, that come from human activity.
That's a huge amount. I mean, do you think that's something that people are generally aware of?
No, I wouldn't think so. And this is roughly the same amount as comes from the United States, which is a very major economy. The reason why deforestation contributes greenhouse gases is that the trees are basically made of carbon. And once those trees are either burned or cut down, that carbon is released in the form of carbon dioxide that goes into the atmosphere. And so trees can then recapture that carbon dioxide when they grow. And so carbon dioxide and carbon is cycling through the living system all the time. But by cutting down trees and preventing them from regrowing, you are actually releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
The world statistics gathered by satellites say fires are actually decreasing, mainly due to changes in agriculture and fire management in the tropics, where biomass is greatest. Of course, those global averages don't mean a lot to people in Indonesia who choked in smoke year after year. I have other concerns. For example, can we just count the number of fires without including fire intensity? Wildfires in California added twice as much carbon to the atmosphere as all their fossil fuel burning for 1 year. I contacted one of the best fire experts, David Bauman from the University of Tasmania. He has been a guest on Radio EcoShock, along with another great fire scientist, Mike Flanagan from the University of Alberta. David quickly replied to my email about this Parrington interview, and he said this: I am of the view that forests are drifting to sources of carbon. I find a lot of remote sensing folks are not really understanding what is happening on the ground. True, there are areas with declining areas burnt, often savannas, but that is only part of the story. The question is one of severity, the impact on vegetation, and frequency of fires that affects the ability of forests to retain carbon. There is no question the boreal forests are vulnerable to switching to sources because the soil carbon is becoming more available for fuel, and the region is warming, and there are more lightning starts. Here in temperate Australia, we are seeing a relentless increase in large, intense fires associated with drought. The forests are not bouncing back because of drought, and the increase in the frequency of fires, many lightning ignited. But the lack of good data on biomass changes, long-term, well before the satellite era data, might make it hard to be certain of anything. So the caveat here is about evidence and not jumping to conclusions by the absence of evidence. The satellite record is very short. The models of emissions are crude, so I would not bet my house or planet on them alone. We need much more data from the field reality. That was a note in a personal email from David Bowman at the University of Tasmania.
Radio EcoShock.
If I did need to bet my home on fire advice, it would come from fire expert Mike Flanagan. Professor Flanagan warned on this show about the emerging extreme danger of fire during climate warming. He explained how fire really works. His advice is widely sought. Mike concurred with Dr. Bowman. He wrote, I agree with David. Most years in Canada, our forests are sources of carbon due to disturbances, fire and insects primarily. Talk to Werner Kurtz if you want to pursue that. Yes, global area burned has decreased, but probably it is more than balanced by fire severity, depth of burn, in other regions. If you look at many forests over the long term, they are close to carbon neutral unless there is a change in state, forest to grassland. However, peatlands have been carbon sinks for millennia, but are now more vulnerable to wildland fire due to increased aridity in many parts of the world. These peatlands have about a third of the terrestrial carbon and can release a significant amount of greenhouse gases, see the paper by Susan Page, on Indonesian fires in Nature around 2001. Much of the global peatlands are in the boreal that has a significant increase in area burned. Also, there is an interaction between warming, fire, and the thawing of permafrost. Lastly, satellite observations have lots of caveats, and our models are not good enough yet, so we need more observations and more research, which is a common refrain with researchers. And that is a quote from Professor Michael Flanagan. Here is another critical issue. Even if emissions from wildfires are declining, that does not suggest they're not adding greenhouse gases and to global warming. To be fair, I had a whole series of questions about this role of carbon in fires, which Mark Parrington declined to answer. Like all honest scientists, Mark did not want to go outside his definitive expertise. I really need to take this up with carbon counters and dig much more into my research. Even a surface Google search shows the big questions about fire and climate change are still either unknown or disputed. There are two major organizations monitoring wildfires and carbon, and they produce different, and some would say contradictory, information. Check out this from Yale 360 at Yale University. Quote, one database, Global Forest Watch, is compiled from satellite images by the World Resources Institute, a Washington think tank. It paints a gloomy picture, putting the decline in tree cover last year at 72.6 million acres, almost 50% more than in 2015. That analysis is supported by on-the-ground observations, especially in Southeast Asia, where forest continues to be converted to oil palm. The other main source for deforestation data, the Global Forest Resources Assessment, the FRA, which is compiled from government inventories by the Rome-based UN Food and Agriculture Organization, is less bleak. It estimates the annual net loss, once forest regrowth is taken into account, at barely a tenth as much, just 8.2 million acres. It says deforestation rates have declined by more than 50% in the past decade, end quote. So who do you believe? Well, here is a brief report from the excellent Canadian radio program Quirks and Quarks.
And with that, it's time for another Quirks and Quarks question.
Hello, my name is Gary Shire from Vancouver. I would like to ask, what is the relative size of the carbon emission from the forest fires compared with that from fossil fuel use?
And here's the answer.
My name is Werner Kurtz, and I'm a senior research scientist with Natural Resources Canada in Victoria, British Columbia. I lead the team that develops Canada's forest greenhouse gas inventories and the Forest Carbon Management Project of the Pacific Institute for Climate Solutions at the University of Victoria. In answer to the question, in 2017, about 1.2 million hectares burned in British Columbia, and in 2018, the area burned was even more, about 1.3 million hectares, and many fires are still burning. This is unprecedented in BC's recorded fire history. Fires release carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, such as methane, into the atmosphere. Our team is still working on developing the estimates of emissions using satellite data, forest inventories, and computer models, but our initial and still unofficial estimate is that the direct emissions in 2017 were around 150 million tons of carbon dioxide, with an uncertainty of plus or minus 30 million tons. These emissions are 2 to 3 times the emissions from fossil fuel burning and other activities in all sectors in BC's greenhouse gas inventory. But the impacts on the atmosphere are even greater because the many trees killed by fires will decompose over the next decades, releasing even more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Fortunately, most forests affected by wildfires will regrow and remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere in the next decades.
Dr. Verna Kurtz is a senior research scientist with Natural Resources Canada and the Pacific Institute for Climate Solutions in Victoria, British Columbia. So have you got a science question that we can answer? Email us at quirks@cbc.ca or send it to us on Twitter or Facebook. All the links are online at cbc.ca/quirks.
Find a link to that audio from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in my show blog at ecoshock.org. The whole issue of fire and climate is very complex. For example, satellite images are good at detecting when forests disappear after fires are logging, but poor at sensing their slow and patchy rate of return. Nor can satellites tell us if the returning vegetation can capture as much carbon or sequester it as long as the original forest. Plus, forest fire smoke actually cools the planet somewhat for up to a year, reducing the warming we might have expected. For me, there are two bottom lines. The first is, the forest is much more than carbon. Studies continue to warn that species are going extinct as forests are cut down and or burned. And human lives are scarred by that fire fear. I can speak to that. But the second takeaway is simple. Are forest fires adding more carbon to the atmosphere than is being reabsorbed by new growth or by other sinks, like the ocean? My non-scientific general survey finds agreement that fires are a significant factor in warming. They account for up to 8% of global greenhouse gas emissions each year. If true, 8% is still minor compared to the really big source of damaging carbon into the sky, and that is humans burning fossil fuels. As summer heats up here in the Northern Hemisphere, we have our evacuation bags still packed in case fire burns over the hills. I hope that California is spared with all the troubles that they have this year. I hope that Australia can be spared next year. But during a pandemic, where would we go? How could firefighters camp and work battling both fire and COVID-19? New studies report that pollution makes COVID-19 more lethal, as does smoking. Will wildfires smoke make the pandemic worse? There's so much more to learn, and I hope we don't learn it by harsh experience. Reporting from the Fire Zone, I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. Please join us again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
Beachfront condo, an SUV. My flight to Vegas was worry-free. I don't worry about climate change. Those green freaks can worry for me. There's no such thing as... cataracts, lots of fat. My meat is greasy, my wallet's flat. I don't worry, I got TV. My man in the White House will look out for me. No such thing as... over, my car loan's shot. My closet full of clothes tells you who I'm not. Don't call my number, I'm not home. Don't call another, you're all alone. Don't call me liberal, cause I'm not one. Look at me sideways, I'll show you my gun. Down in the alley, I buy my pills. If the doctor won't do it, can't cure my ills. There's no such thing as... climate change. Don't even bother, don't even talk.
I don't want to hear. Take a nice long walk. Your so-called science, your so-called facts, you're never gonna change the way we act. There's no such thing as climate change.